Central banks have held the financial world in their grip for much of the 20th century and beyond. But is their reign coming to an end? I'm Adam Bolton, and welcome to this episode of Worldview. With the help of leading experts, we examine the most important issues of our time. This week, we're putting the spotlight on central banks, such as the US Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England. In this episode, we'll be speaking to the former Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, along with the journalist and author, Merin Somerset Webb. We'll discuss Lord King's time at the helm of the Bank of England, which included the 2008 financial crisis and its lingering legacy. Then Ian Martin, editor-in-chief of Engelsberg Ideas, will consider the enormous financial challenges that face the world today and what that might mean for the future of central banks. First, some history. I spoke to the economic historian Samuel Gregg, asking him to take us back to the origins of central banks and to explain their role.
Well, a central bank is essentially the government institution. And they weren't always government institutions, but today they are the government institution that is primarily responsible for ensuring monetary stability. And by that I mean the avoidance of severe fluctuations in the value of a currency that have nothing to do with what's going on in the market. So that's their essential function in today's world. Now, some of them have more than one mandate. So, for example, the Federal Reserve has what's called price stability, in other words, monetary stability as its central objective. But it also has maximum employment as the other part of its mandate. So central banks, their central function remains monetary stability. But certainly since the mid-20th century, they have often found themselves lumbered with other responsibilities that some would say don't really reflect their central purpose.
Let's go right back. Credit is given to Sweden for having the Swedish Riksbank as the first central bank in 1668. Is that justified?
Yes, under the definition of central bank that I just offered, I think that's a fair description. And it was started as a private institution, like most central banks were, again, until the 20th century. But in the case of the Riksbank, it was the monarch who made the decisions about who managed it. And he also outlined regulations that were supposed to govern the way that it operated. So that was very different from other banks at the time. It moved from being managed directly by the monarchy towards what you would call the Estates General, or more or less a type of Swedish parliament. So that's its particular development. In the early 18th century, it was granted permission to issue what were called credit notes. So this is where you start to see the central bank assuming a role for not just what we would call monetary stability, but also providing a currency that other people would use. And remember, at this time in European history, currency, paper currency, to the extent that it's issued, is linked usually to some type of metallic object, usually gold or silver.
And then we've got the Bank of England coming in 1694. How was that different from the Riksbank?
Well, the Bank of England is a little different because it arose out of the need for the government to be able to manage its massive debts as a consequence of the wars in which Britain found itself involved towards the end of the 17th century. It's following the Glorious Revolution of 1688, so we have the conflict between William III of Orange and his wife, Queen Mary. And of course, you have a very active Jacobite movement. You also have Britain at this time heavily involved as a consequence of William III becoming king in Holland's wars against Louis XIV's France. So there was a lot of spending on war at this particular period of time. And this left the country's finances in somewhat of a state of disarray. The government needed to be funded. So the idea was to finance government debt by private subscription by individual shareholders. This is very different from the way that central banking developed in Sweden, as I think we can see already. And let's remember that it remained a private bank for the next, almost 300 years.
And a doctrine emerged during that period of the responsibility doctrine. What was that?
Well, I think the best way of describing the responsibility doctrine can be found in Walter Baggio's writings in the 19th century about what central banks were supposed to do. And in this sense, we're really talking about this idea of lender of last resort, that if there is some type of crisis in the banking sector, or you start to have a bank fail and you start to have a run on banks and a crisis and contagion starts to develop throughout the financial sector of the economy, you need to have a type of institution that is the lender of last resort that will guarantee the financial stability of the system by being willing to step in and lend money to banks that are insolvent until the point that they can either be wound up or made solvent under their own volition. Now, this doesn't mean that it was followed precisely in practice. Central bankers have always, to a certain extent, played games with the way that they go about doing this. But it was very important because it basically involved the extension of what you might call a financial safety net. The effect was to greatly reduce the incidence of what we would call banking panics in economies at the time. And that's the function that they still play today.
And when the Napoleonic era came in the Banque de France, we're right in saying we also see the Banque de France doing something that banks do today, which is trying to control inflation.
Absolutely, because the Banque de France, which came into being really as a consequence of Napoleon becoming the first consul of France in the late 18th century, and France is immersed in inflation as the assignats, which had been issued by successive revolutionary governments, became increasingly worthless. And one of the great reforms that Napoleon instituted as a domestic ruler was to restore financial stability to the French currency by setting up the Banque de France as the lender of last resort, but also as the institution that would link the currency to some sort of metallic object, in this case, gold. So in that sense, the Banque de France was there to ensure monetary stability in a country in which monetary stability had been absent for almost 8 years.
And was that where the gold standard came from?
It's part of the process by which the gold standard started emerging and came to full fruition by the, I guess, the last quarter of the 19th century. And the idea is that banks would link their currency to a certain degree of gold. So in other words, the basic rule was to adhere to convertibility of the currency into gold at a fixed price. And more central banks, but especially the Bank of England, learned throughout the 19th century that the way to maintain monetary stability was to maintain this gold convertibility of the currency in the face of both external and internal shocks. What's interesting about this is that there was no one from the top down, there was no global organization that was imposing this. It was the free, voluntary adherence of what we would call central banks today to these unwritten rules about linking the currency to gold and a willingness to exchange the currency for a set amount of gold, or what we call parity. And when more and more nations start doing this, we start to see the emergence of what's called the classic gold standard.
And we've been talking about nation states, Sweden, France, Britain. What about the United States, a federation, as it were? What were they doing to guarantee banking? Because I have to say, one sort of slightly associates America with banking failures.
Absolutely. Well, and what's also interesting about it is that there was an enormous fight right from the beginning of the United States about whether having a type of central bank was in fact constitutional. This was not resolved for several decades. And the United States went through several different experiments with its currency. The federal government had the responsibility of issuing the currency, but there was an enormous argument about whether one would give this type of power to a central institution that we call the Federal Reserve today. And it was a very slow and painful learning process. So throughout the 19th century, there were successive waves of bank collapses, and there were major learning things that happened during what I think we would call the disasters of the Great Depression, or what was called the Great Contraction. And this was basically precipitated by monetary collapse in the United States. But if you go back to the central bank and the forming of the Federal Reserve, basically in 1913, this followed the conviction that is even still disputed today, that you needed some type of institution that would act as a lender of last resort. And so that's the beginnings of the Federal Reserve in the United States. But even today, there's arguments among those people who follow monetary policy or who are engaged in discussing and writing about these things about whether it's constitutional and whether the Federal Reserve functions in the way that it was originally envisaged to function.
And it was an issue coming out of the Civil War, going back to the middle of the 19th century, because there had been this free banking era.
Yes, there was a free banking era, and there was also major disputes about whether gold or silver was the optimal metal to which banks should be linking their currencies. So because there was this constitutional dispute about the legitimacy of even having these things in the first place, there was a great deal of uncertainty that marked a great deal of the second half of the 19th century about the dollar and the ultimate foundations of it, and whether you needed to have some type of lender of last resort. Effectively, for much of that period, big Wall Street banks effectively acted as lender of last resort, but as private institutions.
Sam Gregg there. But that didn't last. Perhaps the greatest period of tumult in modern times for central banks occurred in 2007 to 2008, when Mervyn King was governor of the Bank of England. I asked him first, how much power do central banks have in shaping the financial systems of the world?
They have a large impact in terms of being able to influence inflation, to deal with failings in the banking system. But they can't really affect the long-run growth rate of the economy. That reflects much more fundamental factors that drive productivity. So very important, yes, but not overpowerful.
Meryn, do we expect too much of them, really?
Yes, we definitely do. I mean, I think one of the interesting dynamics of the last couple of decades is the way that we've come to believe that it has been central banks that have been entirely responsible for the very long period of low inflation / disinflation, when in fact there have been a series of global dynamics that have come together to allow us to live until very recently in a deflationary kind of world. So we've had, you know, the opening of the global economy to China, China joining the WTO was a huge part of that. Again, the rise in labour supply via Eastern Europe and via China. We've had low levels of wages. We've had globalization, you know, the introduction of what the historian Neil Ferguson used to call Chimerica, which of course is slowly disintegrating now. But all these dynamics that brought us a very low inflation environment and allowed the central banks to, and Mervyn will disagree with me perhaps, but a relatively easy environment for central banks to operate in and say, look, 2% is our target and it's just happening and we did this, when perhaps maybe they didn't do quite as much as they might have liked to think. And now we come to today when the environment is very, very different and we look to the central banks in the belief that they can control inflation, only to find that not only can they not control inflation in an environment where those disinflationary dynamics have swapped around, but their models are telling them the wrong things anyway. So I think, yes, we do think, or we have been led to believe over the last couple of decades, that the central banks have more power over the inflationary environment than perhaps they do, and perhaps they like to think they do.
Where I disagree with Meryn, I think, is when she said central banks can't control inflation, when what happened was that they didn't control inflation. They did allow inflation to rise by printing a very large amount of money during the pandemic that wasn't needed. And we ended up in a situation where we had too much money chasing too few goods. and that's a well-known recipe for inflation. Now, central banks are no longer printing money, so inflation will, I think, ultimately come back to closer to the target, but it may be a rather painful journey back.
Marina, are targets useful at all, do you think?
Yes, of course targets are useful. It's good to know what everyone is aiming for, and it's good to have, you know, a stable target of some kind. You know, and I'd be fascinated to know Mervyn's views on this, but the 2% target is a very strange thing. You know, it's very random. No one's quite sure why we have 2%, not 3% or 1.5% or 4%, whatever it is. You know, I did spend some time a couple of years ago trying to find out where 2% actually started, and it was in New Zealand where they first put in place the 2% target, but it came originally, as far as I can see, unless Mervyn can push it back earlier for me. The first thing I can find on it is January 1965, where the chief of the financial studies division at the IMF wrote a paper. He called it Inflation and Growth, the Statistical Evidence, and it was designed for IMF staff. And in it, he wrote about why 2% worked and why he thought that in relatively advanced economies, was the phrase he used, it looked to be the optimum inflation level. It encouraged growth in output, but without allowing inflation to run too far. And then on we go for all the central banks picking it up. But, you know, it's based on something fairly amorphous, and there's no real proof that this is the right level, because who can possibly know? And now, of course, we're beginning to see lots of mutterings about shifting it.
The idea of the inflation target was really to have a round number that everyone would understand, that was a level of inflation that people wouldn't think mattered to them very much. And the reason for having a positive number at all is that many of the effective improvements in the quality of goods and services are not captured in the official inflation numbers. So a measured inflation rate of 2% probably corresponds to an actual inflation rate of somewhere between 0.5% and 1%. And you can't have a target of 1.6%. I mean, it becomes sort of ridiculous. So it's in order to hold central banks accountable, so that when central banks go to Parliament, Parliament can say, well, your target's 2%, it's 3.5%. What are you going to do to bring it back? And that enables a central bank to have a narrative which explains what they're trying to do. Yes, of course, there's nothing magic about 2%. There are no natural constants in economics at all. But the idea of saying, well, inflation is above target, this is pretty inconvenient, why don't we just raise the target, isn't very compelling, and it simply gives the impression that central banks will stop trying to keep inflation down. So I think it'd be a big mistake to play and change the target. Leave it where it is, but make sure that central banks adopt policies that are consistent in the medium term with ensuring that inflation meets that target.
Lord King, is the real point about central banks that they have more economic muscle than anyone else in a particular country? And, you know, you mentioned the banking crisis. The point there surely was that ultimately the bank, backed by the British government, could tell the financial sector what to do.
I think it requires not just the central bank, but also the government to be able to exercise that degree of muscle. And I think we saw in the recent problems with Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse that in all three countries involved, the US, UK and Switzerland, that without the intervention of politicians, things might well have been handled rather differently and arguably better. But politicians will never stand aside when there is a major economic problem. And the reason we delegate interest rate policy to central banks is because this is one area of policy that we don't want politicians interfering in. But I don't think it makes central banks sort of overpowerful. They have the ability to smooth and manage the path of the economy in the short run. And that's why we don't give that power to politicians. But I think on deeper questions of financial or economic structure, it really is down to governments and politicians.
Marion, is it better that politicians take the lead on settling these matters?
Well, on big matters, it's always better that democratically elected parties take the lead on things. I mean, I agree with Lord King that it's useful to have something that can't be touched by politicians, but of course it's still delegated by politicians, that power, so it's very changeable. But I do think that we are moving into an environment now where, you know, we've talked about how we have believed that central banks have this great power over the last decade or so, and now we're moving more into an environment where everything is becoming increasingly politicized, and the discussion about SVB and the way in that politicians intervened to solve the problem to the extent that it is solved, you know, that is another part of the collectivization of the financial system as opposed to the allowing it to collapse. You know, everyone steps in. So we're moving into an environment where fiscal authorities, I think, will have more power or more influence than we might have perceived them to have had over the last decade, if that's fair.
Lord King, the biggest event or series of events of your time as Governor of the Bank of England was undoubtedly the banking crisis. Looking back on that, what do you see as being the lessons for how central banks should or perhaps should not operate?
Well, I think the big lesson for central banks was that when the banking system gets into difficulty, the central bank is drawn in inextricably because of its role as a lender of last resort. In a crisis, the only source of cash essentially is the central bank. So central banks cannot be excluded from the process of monitoring the banking system, standing ready to lend money when it's needed. And I think in retrospect, the reforms of 1997, which gave banking supervision to the Financial Services Authority, turned out to be a mistake in one sense, in that in 1997, I remember very clearly that people did not think that there would be a crisis of the banking system. And it was all about investor protection, consumer protection, insider trading. That kind of issue is not one for central banks. So understandably, all of that was taken away and given to the new FSA. But as it turned out, FSA too didn't think there would be a major banking crisis. And so it rather crept up, and banks behaved in a way just prior to the financial crisis to get themselves into a very fragile position. When that was revealed, then the central bank really had to step in. And since then, we've given a lot more power to the central bank. And I'm sure in years to come, there will be further debate about whether we've given too much work to the central bank to carry out, whether we need to readjust a bit. I'm sure that will be on the agenda again. But the big lesson, I think, was that there is no point saying to central banks, the only thing you should do is just have low inflation. If, when there's a banking crisis, the central bank is forced to act as a lender of last resort and doesn't have available to it the information that it needs to carry out that task, I'm not sure we've actually got a regulatory system today that really meets that objective. And I think we've created this horrendous bureaucratic set of regulations, tens of thousands of pages, and yet banks will still fail. And you've got, as we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, regulators stepping in and making it up as they went along. We haven't got to the final stepping stone yet for a sensible regulatory system.
Merin, do you agree?
Well, I think it doesn't matter what you do, banks will always fail. Someone will always find a way. And when you look at
the question, surely, is whether they are allowed to fail or whether, as perhaps some of the public see, in the end, they're always bailed out by the taxpayer.
Well, I think at this point, it doesn't really matter what you think. They are always going to be bailed out by the taxpayer. And we've crossed that Rubicon now, haven't we? We've crossed so many lines over the last decade, lines that we thought would never be crossed the last two decades, you know, from QE becoming not an emergency measure, but to an ordinary part of a toolkit, to the extraordinary money printing during the COVID crisis. You know, the idea, I'm sure Lord King has read all the same books that I did about modern monetary theory in advance of the introduction of all the measures around COVID, but to see it suddenly being put into action so quickly, something we thought we wouldn't see for a while, put into action, this massive money printing and the distributing of that money into the pockets of everyone in the country at fairly extreme levels. And then the sort of weird surprise as that led to very high inflation that's almost impossible to tame. You know, that was a fascinating Rubicon to cross so quickly. So as I say, I don't think the question is, should banks be left to fail or should they be bailed out by the government? Because that ship has sailed.
I don't think that's true. I think the phrase I liked that Adam used was bailed out by the taxpayer. And I do think that you're right, that banks will fail. And we have two things in place to decide. First of all, we have to decide whether a bank should come to an end and be broken up and distributed elsewhere. That's what's happened to Credit Suisse, and it should have happened a long time ago. The regulator was very ineffective. The second is that when a bank fails and needs access to liquidity in order to ensure the depositors don't panic and run, then you can put in place before the crisis occurs, before bank runs, a framework in which the central bank is quite happy to lend to a bank in trouble, because it knows it's going to receive in return collateral. It's acting like a pawnbroker. And that collateral is something which the central bank has approved as being sufficient to justify then providing cash to support the depositors. And I think this is the direction in which we are gradually going. The Fed, when it stepped in with Silicon Valley Bank, pretty much put into place retrospectively the sort of scheme I'd like to see in place. So I think we haven't got the right system yet, but we can get a system in which banks will fail, will be allowed to fail, but nevertheless the depositors will be supported and protected, but not at the expense of taxpayers, but at the expense of how the bank was managed and run before the depositors decided to leave.
One final question for both of you, really, starting with you, Merin. What changes would you like to see to make the central banks operate better, have a better system for the benefit of the economies in which they are responsible?
I think the answer to that really is very simple, and it goes back to what we've been discussing already, which is that we are asking far too much of central banks. They've now got fingers in far too many pies and far too many responsibilities. And it's very difficult to say, you know, you're responsible for inflation, but you're also responsible for financial stability across the board with this huge sort of raft after raft of regulation that comes with it. So I think, and I hope that Lord King would agree with me, that we're making things possibly too complicated for the banks.
Lord King?
Yes. When the new Labour government in 1997 made the Bank of England independent, it gave a very simple, clean remit to the Bank of England, essentially keep inflation low and stable, and a proper system of accountability for that. If you look at the remits which successive chancellors have given to the Bank of England since, they've got bigger, longer, more complicated. That's not a good idea. Any public sector institution that is given a degree of independence ought to have a simple, clear objective that everyone in the organisation understands, that's what they're about, and everyone outside it can hold the institution accountable for meeting that objective. And I think going back to that remit of 1997 will be a very good start.
And as a former governor of the Bank of England, is there any central bank around the world that you envy and think, you know, they got the system right in that country?
No, I actually think the bank is in a stronger position than most. I think the European Central Bank is in a much more complicated position, and it's made its own situation more difficult by embracing climate change as a key objective. That makes no sense when it's still trying to hold the euro area together. I think the Federal Reserve has great challenges in dealing with Congress, because really what it needs is to be held accountable by Congress for one thing, which is price stability. And instead, Congress wants the central bank to get involved in the allocation of credit to different groups in society, to deal with inequality, etc. That's not a happy position for the Federal Reserve. So I think the Bank of England's in a good position, but I think that it does need some changes, and it needs to be able to focus on its main remit.
Lord King and Merin Somerset-Webb there of Bloomberg. So where does this leave central banks today? Does their role require a rethink? I asked Ian Martin, are central banks becoming more or less important?
There's been a fashion in recent years for talking about crypto and the extraordinary technological changes, which are, in theory, its advocates say, going to render central banks irrelevant. So this means that you create other forms of money, digital forms of money, cryptocurrencies, and the central banks just sort of fade away. And I think that what you're seeing in this recent wave of disasters and potential crises is that turning out to just be false, a mirage, if you like. Because when it comes to it, when there's a crisis, as you heard from Lord King earlier, the central banks are the institutions on behalf of the state. They are the state when it comes to money. They're who consumers turn to.
They've got more money than anyone else, and they can create money.
I mean, the theory was that crypto would just negate all of that because it could also create money. But that then raises the question, in a crisis, which form of money is trusted more? And is the form of money which is backed by the state and the authority of the state trusted more than crypto? Well, some of us thought this would always be the case, but it turns out that it's the state that is trusted more. That introduces all sorts of problems, which we can talk about as well. But I think it is part of a shift, which I think is regrettable in certain ways, but towards a more collectivist, statist era. You just come out of a pandemic, we're in a war era, and when those things happen, the state tends to get more powerful, not less. And I think money is part of that. And if the state is getting bigger and more powerful in Europe and in the US in particular, but also in authoritarian regimes, then their suppliers of money, the creators of money and the institutions which underpin trust in the system are going to get bigger. I mean, I keep, you know, in a way trying to get away from the subject of central banks and money and finance and how it works. Because when I wrote books about the financial crisis in 2008 and the collapse of banks and how money works and flows across continents, I sort of hoped it would be a one-off. And I did it because I didn't necessarily understand how it worked. I thought I had a grasp of economics, but then I realized I didn't really understand the wiring of the global economy. But the reality is it keeps coming back every 10, 20 years through human history, through the development of capitalism, you get these waves of crisis. And central banks are, in the modern era, the institutions we look to solve those crises.
Although we heard Lord King say that ultimately the actions which central banks take are not taken by the experts in the bank. They are as a result of political direction.
Yes, that's true. And that is an essential component of the system, that you have to have democratic oversight. And there was a great fashion in the sort of started in the 80s, well, in the 90s, to make central banks independent of political control. I think that went a bit wrong, actually, in the run-up to the financial crisis, because the politicians thought, well, we don't need to worry about that. We have contracted that out to the experts over there, the various central banks. They are inflation targeting. They can sort of control things. Everything seems benign. And it's the job of politics to raise the money and spend the money and pursue other policies, foreign policy. And then suddenly, in a crisis, with this crunch in 2007, 2008, you realise that that's a myth. And politicians have to, once again, as Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling did in the UK, and a team in the US did as well, had to get very, very involved. I mean, there is a truth about politics, which I've observed. It's not necessarily a criticism of politicians in major democracies, but that they generally don't understand this stuff. And that is, I think, in a way, understandable. I think most people don't.
And you mentioned democratic control, but as we get a globalized financial system and China, for example, joins it, it's not necessarily democratic political intervention, is it?
No, but then something else is happening in the world of central banks and global finance right now, which is that China is almost, and China and other authoritarian allies, are essentially trying to create a potential rival system. If you look, there have been reports in the last few months of what's going on in terms of the credit lines that China extends to client countries who've got into bed with China wanting loans. And they're almost setting up a rival system to the IMF and the World Bank.
To which they belong.
Precisely. Those institutions were invented by politicians and central bankers after the Second World War to create a globalized system. That system is fracturing now, and you can see the China-Russia alliance, other client states starting to do their own thing away from the IMF and the World Bank in terms of extending credit. So I'm not sure where it will go, but it looks as though the world is dividing into two political blocks and financial blocks that will be in competition. In the West, I think there's been a bit of a rebalancing and an understanding that central banks, that we put a bit too much faith in central banks in the run-up to 2007 to 2008, and that politicians have to take more of an interest in what they're up to. But it's obviously a very, very different situation. And when it comes to China and Russia, democracy doesn't count.
Yeah, I suppose compared to the banking crisis of 2008 and beyond, or 2007, 2008, people looking at what's happened recently in Switzerland with Credit Suisse and here and in the United States with Silicon Valley Bank would say, yeah, great. I mean, you know, that was the weekend problem. Central banks and government got involved and it was all sorted and we didn't have anything to worry about by Monday evening.
Yes, there's some truth in that. And certainly in the British end of it, what happened was that Silicon Valley Bank UK was swallowed up by HSBC, which is a very big British-based bank. And that probably ends up being a pretty good outcome for the UK economy. And it was a classic, as a historian of the city, it was a classic lifeboat that was floated. And these things are usually done on a Sunday afternoon before the markets open on a Monday. And it was wrapped up pretty cleanly. In terms of Credit Suisse, I mean, we're recording this at a time when we don't know if that is the beginning of some deeper, wider problem in the European financial system. Experts are, and I've never known experts to be this divided on what it actually means, because some people will tell you the banks are all much better capitalized than they were last time, which is true, though banks are very well capitalized until they're not, if you get a series of bank runs, and that things are more stable and that central banks are in a much better health and better position than they were in 2008. And that may be the case, but you're also vulnerable to all sorts of shocks. I mean, the story of the last year or so is really about rising interest rates, which is about the power of central banks. And I think it's worth remembering in all of this, central bankers can be very clever people, I have no doubt about it, but we shouldn't overestimate the extent to which they know everything. They don't. They have a lot of data in front of them, and some of them are very well trained, but they are guessing as well. They don't have some kind of crystal ball about precisely where to pitch interest rates. And they have to engage with politicians, and they exist in a democracy. So they have a very, very difficult job. But what is clear is that the situation that they face now is as potentially perilous, with so much going on, a war, inflation, concerns about recession, as it's been at any time in the last 20 or so years.
And would you pick out your favourite central banker?
Paul Volcker, definitely, for that pivot in the 1970s, 1980s in US policy, where inflation was out of control, government was out of control, and Volcker saw things very clearly. And it's the best example in the central bank era of a central banker acting in genuine national interest and changing the course of history, for which he ended up being removed by Ronald Reagan. But still, he is a legend of central banks.
Ian Martin. From the gold standard to Bretton Woods to the present day, there have been many manifestations of central banks over the past 400 years. We can only guess what the next one will be. This has been Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. Mari Jessel is the series producer, Eve Webster the producer, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. If you enjoyed this episode of Worldview, please subscribe and rate our podcast. You can also visit engelsbergideas.com to find more podcasts and thought-provoking writing. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.